radiant beach and cool jeweled moon. Couples naked race down by its quiet side. And we laugh like soft, mad children smart in the woolly cotton brains of infancy. The music and voices are all around us.
This program was produced by the late Robert Knight with assistance from Catherine Davis and Paulette Spencer.
I guess the wolf wants to cry a second time. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, the first of two in a row that you are going to be hearing this morning. I will be live with Rick Bowes. I am Jim Freund from 1:30 till 3. And then at 3, Margot Adler and I will have a recorded episode. Robert Knight before, Margot Adler after. Worthwhile. Good morning. Yes, I know last week that I announced that this week our guest was going to be Veronica Shaness, but Professor Shaness had to bow out.
I'm going to imitate her.
You're going, Rick Bowes is going to imitate her. Okay. The look, I don't think so. Last time I saw Veronica, she was in the, Barbara Krasnoff was reading a story at ReaderCon, and then she was followed by D.T. Friedman and A.C. Wise. And, you know, these are three worthy readers, and I was recording and filming. And unfortunately, half an hour of this bled over into half of the Shirley Jackson Awards. And people, there wasn't anything after those readings. This is Sunday afternoon, early afternoon.
Right.
And I wand, and all of a sudden I realize, oh my God, I've got to pack up the equipment and go to the main auditorium where the awards were being given. And I rush in there, and there is Veronica Shaness on stage, crying with happiness, clutching the award. I ran up to the stage, took a couple of pictures as she got down. Now, one of the reasons that I went there was also because a gentleman by the name of Sam J. Miller was also nominated.
Yeah, I would listen to the...
And I didn't think he was likely... Oh, you heard him on the air.
I heard him on the air.
Yeah, so I've told this story, but very briefly, I didn't think that he had won. He was up against some pretty hearty competition in this...
It's a juried award.
It's a juried award, exactly. And it was a story, as a matter of fact, that I had edited the audiobook version of for Lightspeed Magazine.
I know.
I should say the Hugo Award-winning Lightspeed Magazine.
Right.
And just as Sam J. Miller has now legally changed his name, or is in the process of doing, he keeps threatening us, you know, to Shirley Jackson Award. Well, that gives away the end of the story.
It's like guys who get their first girlfriend's name tattooed on their arm. I mean, does he ever think he's ever going to win another award?
Gee, do you think he's going to get the name Shirley Jackson tattooed on anything? And if so, what is his husband going to think of that? I've only met his husband once.
His husband is a very patient man, as he would have to be.
Yes. I mean, at one time, you know, I found out that at a reading, Sam's husband was there. I didn't even realize that Sam was married. I don't know why it didn't occur to me, but he's happily married. And I said, well, wait, which person was he? You know, because I knew where people were. And he said, he was the most beautiful person in the room. It's like, oh, well, yeah, that really, really...
He's a very good-looking guy.
Yes, I've met him since. I concede the point. But, you know, after you've had a room full of 50 people, and I wasn't looking at people for their good-looking traits.
Really?
Yeah, really.
I judge everything on that.
Do you?
Yes, I do.
There are so many wise ass remarks, self-deprecating, of course, that I could make, and I'm withholding. By the way, I do have to do one bit of business before. I know you want to start right in reading.
No, I also wanted to mention Chris's movie.
Okay, well. I have an announcement, and then you can do your announcements, or Chris's announcement.
Yes.
Speaking of the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, we have taken the summer off. I am so pleased that I gave this time to myself. And we are starting up again, September 9th. Normally, it would be the first Tuesday of the month, but in the case of September, that's often... Well, it's always after Labor Day and is often right after Worldcon. And it wasn't after Worldcon this year because Worldcon was in London. But it is the day after Labor Day, and so we chose the second day. Now, the current conditions of the home, Soho Gallery for Digital Art, is if we do not use the first Tuesday, we are not in there. We have the right to use the first Tuesday, but somebody else now leases the building. But it's in the lease that I get first Tuesdays. But if I'm not there first Tuesday, I don't get in. So we're moving for 1 month and 1 month only. No, 2 months, because December. The Gallery Lala, an artisan's market that is there, will be... They need both floors. And we're in the dungeon, the cabaret space, I should say. So we're going to... For the first time ever, we are moving... to Brooklyn. We are not just moving to Brooklyn. You look alarmed. You've known this for a while, Rick.
It's the word Brooklyn.
Yeah, I know. You have this phobia about crossing the river.
Yes.
Yeah, I've noticed. I've noticed. And yet you have made it out to Bay Ridge. When escorted by the Hugo Award-winning Ellen Datlow.
Yeah. See, that's the thing. I've never won a Hugo Award. I've never even been nominated for a Hugo Award.
Okay, how do I put this? The Hugo Award is overrated.
It's for sissies.
It's a fan award. It's a peer. It's not a peer.
No, it's
award.
Perfectly. It's a perfectly valid award.
It's a valid award for fans.
Yeah. No. It's
and I'm a fan, but yeah. I'm also a member of, as are you, Science Fiction Writers of America. And they give out a peer award called the Nebula Award.
Right, which is actually, I've been nominated certainly a lot of times for the Nebula Award.
Yes.
But I would say...
Which are your peers saying, this is, you know, somebody among us.
This is somebody who nominated me, and I think I'll nominate them, is what they're saying usually. But
no, you need more than a couple of nominations. Do you know that as many and sometimes more people vote for the Nebula as... Now, this year they had a record of voting on the Hugos, but in previous years it has happened more than once that more people vote for the Nebula than vote for the Hugo.
No, that isn't true. Fewer people vote.
I know the numbers.
Fewer people vote for the Nebula each year. And...
Well, there was one year where there were about 400 people who voted for the Nebula and 300 for the Hugo.
Right. The Hugo
about
has
10
upped,
years ago.
The Hugo has upped its voting members. It's over 1,000 at this point.
Yeah, this year was over 1,500.
The Nebula, now this may have been changed, but the Nebula has been going down. It doesn't take... many votes to get on, or it didn't the last time I ever looked at it.
Well, you know, they change all the rules on nominations and voting and all that, how people...
For the Nebulas?
Yeah. They change all the rules on how you are nominated 3 years ago. The bylaws have been thrown out totally changed.
I remember I voted all of these years.
And I know that you're a nominator, which is to say you nominate people.
I nominate things. I've been nominated. No, the voting is about the same as it was. There's nothing...
Hmm.
What parts of it have you noticed that were changed?
No, I mean, I'm not a voting member. I'm an associate member.
I have seen no...
I think it was 4 years ago. That it all changed. The idea being that they were trying to find a way to become more inclusive of younger writers who were not joining the association.
Well, perhaps they did. But no, I mean, the way that the ballots are... One thing that they did change a few years ago, you could see who had nominated you.
Yeah, they've stopped that now.
That had changed, but it...
They also stopped. There was a point when it was a horse race where you could see exactly how many nominations.
That was
fun. Yeah, you would enjoy that.
I did. I loved
that. Yeah, that was more fun than the Million Writers Award, which you won.
Which with your help.
Well, yes. I helped fix that award for you, and I helped fix that award for Kat Valenti. But then the third...
Kat Valenti? one run going away. If the Million Writers, I'm a judge of the Million Writers this year.
Are you now? Cool.
I am indeed, yes.
But what happened was that because of you, Kat Valenti came up to me at a ReaderCon and said, I understand that you can
You're
fix
Mr. Magic.
Awards for a price.
Yeah.
And
that's right. I added that it was for price.
Yes, you did.
Yeah,
you did.
I didn't pay you anything, but
no,
I figured there was no sense.
Well,
in,
she did. She got me a bar of sugar-free Lady Godiva chocolate.
That is such a tiny reward.
I loved it.
For having violated all that was good and true about that.
Sorry, we stayed within the rules of that award, which have
pretty elastic.
The third year that then all of a sudden, I mean, you and she were the only speculative fiction writers nominated.
Adam Troy Castro also, or was it?
Then that's the next year.
Right.
The next year was Adam Troy Castro.
We were the only ones to win. Other spec fiction writers were nominated.
In your year, you were the only spec fic writer.
And
in her year, she was the only. But then the next year, out of, I think, five nominees, three were speculative fiction. At
that
point,
it's 10 nominees.
Oh, okay. But there were I couldn't choose one person.
Well, that, you know, you could have, but you chose not to.
I chose not to.
Right.
I went for the writers when they were the only ones there.
Now the mainstream writers dominate the thing. For a while there in the, I mean, I won it in 2006.
This is an award, by the way, for original story first published online.
Online, yes. And it's one of the few awards in which there is no genre
restriction. Yeah.
You can be from any genre.
As long as it's fiction.
Right. At that time, spec fiction in terms of online magazines was far ahead of anybody else, so that we were really dominating that award. And now that is no longer true, and there are an awful lot of mainstream and
It sort of finally found an equilibrium,
I guess.
But I think in the beginning it was friends of the person who ran the website and was running the award.
Well,
and I think you snuck in there somehow.
Well, I got
with one of my favorite stories of yours.
I got in there. It was, well, I mean, there's always luck in these things. There's a hole in the city, and that was published by Sci-Fiction.
Which is the first story in Dust Devil
on the Quiet Street. But it was also...
You have to remember to promote your books all the time.
I'm going to do that later, but...
More listeners now.
Right, I'll drive them away with my reading. I had that story. Sci-Fiction had just gone out of business, having been this, like, powerhouse of online speculative fiction. And to some extent, I think people wanted to reward Sci-Fiction. And one of the ways that they did that was by voting for There's a Hole in the City.
Uh-huh.
Certainly, I put it to them that way when I was asking for their vote.
I don't think so.
The
I
other part
the
of it is...
the best story of the year.
I think it was a stupendous story, but I think that about all the stories. I also have, I'm Irish American, and I have a huge family, and they all voted. So that was another part of it. But yes, that was, I won that award. I have never been present when I won an award.
Yes, you've mentioned that.
I've been present when I lost awards, and I behave very badly. I'm sorry to say. I mean, this is a disgraceful thing, but I cry and I carry on.
I was with I will not use the name here. I'll tell you off the air. I was with a major writer who was nominated for Best Novel, and he knew that he wasn't going to win. This was a nebula. And he was well aware of it, and he was totally resigned to it. And Barbara and I shared a table with him and his partner, and he didn't win as expected. He was so upset.
Yes.
And I can't imagine the pressure. I can't begin to imagine the pressure that awards put on people.
It can be very severe, especially, it's not so much in the short forms or that 101 things that the Hugos have, best left-handed.
Yes, exactly.
Small magazine publisher.
I'm not eligible for a Hugo Award because it's best fan cast. There's no podcast, there's no radio. Best fan cast.
Right. But for the...
Nothing against SF Signal, which John DiNardo publishes, which is an excellent podcast. Well, that's neither here nor
there. Right, it's an excellent podcast.
Yes, it is.
But in the novel category,
things become much
tighter.
Oh, I take that back. I've been nominated for 2 major Armstrong Awards, and I won one.
Oh, that's good.
That was a major award.
But the thing with the novels is it is a tougher, it's a more important award in most cases, and I don't know. Most of the awards I've won have been for short form, and I won the Lambda for Menus of the Moon, I think that's about it, actually. I've never won any other.
You've never won a World Fantasy
Award? Never won a World Fantasy Novel Award, no. Won a couple for short forms.
Oh, okay.
In fact, I'm nominated, Dust Devil in a Quiet Street is nominated for a World Fantasy Award this year, and that's the first time I've
Don't
had...
Don't go. Don't go.
I'm afraid I'm going to. And
oh, jeez, Rick. Go to Capclave. It's 2 weeks earlier.
No,
Same city. Go to Capclave. Forget World Fantasy.
I don't believe that
it
has anything.
It's too expensive.
It's very expensive, and I hate...
Barbara and I, we joined World Fantasy. We were going to go when it was up in Toronto 2 years ago. And the day before, Sandy hit.
Well, you were very fortunate.
No, we lost every... I mean...
You lost all your...
We lost all the money. It's
you
a
did.
Lot.
Well, and you're very
couldn't
unfortunate.
Sell the tickets. Very, very expensive.
I, on the other hand, had no desire to go. But...
Well, you shouldn't go. You shouldn't go to World Fantasy for reasons already stated during this broadcast.
Well, there are some things that I have to do there.
Well, then don't go to the awards. How's that?
Well, the awards themselves... I've been to a World Fantasy Awards where I was nominated and I didn't win, and...
Well, that's the point. Going, you don't win. So don't go to the awards. You go to the convention,
no,
fine.
I think
but
you
don't
have,
go to the awards.
I think you're just superstitious.
You're the one who brought this up.
I'm the one who brought it up.
Yes,
that's true. I had no idea. I had no idea you were going to take this so
and run with it.
Run with it. I think I'm going to read.
I'm going to finish my promo, and then you're going to do
what,
a promo.
Right. You do
my
a promo
is that yeah. The next New York Review of Science Fiction Readings is, everything stopped when I used the B word, Brooklyn. It's going to be at 388 Atlantic Avenue, which is a building called the Commons Brooklyn. Not the Brooklyn Commons, but the Commons Brooklyn.
And nothing is more common than Brooklyn.
It's a very special place. It is a lovely building. We can seat over 100 people. And we may need to, because our readers are Paul DiFilippo and Walter Mosley. And Walter... people like Paul and show up for his readings. He's read for us about 3 or 4 times. But this is Walter Mosley's second time reading for us. Cherie Renee Thomas, when she ran the series, had him in. At the Vineyard Theater.
Yep, I remember.
We were thrown out of there so they could do Avenue Q, as a matter of fact, eventually. And Mosley is a wonderful reader, nice guy, has a new novella ebook out, which he will be reading from there, called Jack Strong, from Open Road Media. And I hadn't realized, but both of them are Open Road Media writers.
Yes, I may join them there.
So September 9th, Doors open at 6:30. Admission is free. Donations are begged for. And when you walk in, the ground floor is the performance space. If you made the mistake of going up to the third floor, you would be find yourself inside the offices of WBAI.
I didn't know they had offices.
Yes, we do. We're at 388 Atlantic Avenue. So, the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings at 388 Atlantic Avenue, September 9th. Doors open at 6:30. I am not using the space in any connection with BAI. I am renting the space from the same woman who wonderfully rents office space to the management of WBAI. That is where it's a gorgeous building. We get CCNY, which is a nice place, but
it's a nice place.
Yeah, I have to travel a long way. I can get to 388 Atlantic. So it's near the Hoyt Schermerhorn subway station, about a block and a half away, or it's near the Atlantic Avenue station, which has like every train in the world going there.
Really?
Yeah, well,
the Orient Express pulls right in
there? The LIRR goes there.
Oh, same thing.
Yeah, it really is. It's about five blocks... it's about seven blocks away from the... I know if I call the station by the wrong name, you're going to be all over me. It's about seven blocks away from the Barclays Center stop.
Oh, the Barclays Center stop.
You see, I knew this was going to get you. The Atlantic Avenue / Barclays Center stop, but it's about a block and a half away from Hoyt Schermerhorn.
I will never be able to find it, so it's like...
We'll have you escorted. In.
Oh, in. Oh, in. That will be a change.
Yes. So that's September 9th. Now, there's a movie opening Friday.
There is indeed. It's Jamie Marks is Dead, which is based on the novel One for Sorrow by Chris Barzak.
Wonderful novel.
It's a wonderful novel. It isn't, you know. It was an adult novel. Now, if it came came out now, it would be YA. But in those days, it wasn't.
Wasn't it marketed as YA?
A lot of...
Because I got all the PR for it.
No, it wasn't marketed as YA.
Oh, okay.
It came out as a, you know, to the extent that genre novels are adult novels.
It's a GB. It's a good book.
It's a great book. It's a great book.
It's a GB novel.
And it's a very good movie. And it's about ghosts and teenagers. And... the performances are quite extraordinary by the young actors. It's playing at the Village Cinema on, 12th Street? I can never remember which street it's on.
Yeah, Village Cinema is on 12th.
And it's opening on Friday. And, you know, take a look. Take a look. You owe it to yourself to go to that movie.
Yes. Yeah. And
he's my godchild, so what can I do?
There you go.
I mean, Chris is.
Yes.
Yes, so...
Not
now
Jamie
we've done
Marks.
That. No, Jamie Marks is a fictional
dead.
Character. He's dead also. Yeah. Yes, indeed. But anyway, now that we've done that.
Yes. Now
I can start to read.
Yes, sir.
This is I'm reading. This is the beginning of a story.
Although before you begin,
yes,
let me just do an official station break that this is WBAI New York.
Well, that does sound so official.
It's 2 minutes early, but...
It's 2 minutes early, but yes, it's nonetheless. Okay. This is called Rascal Saturday, and it's the beginning of a story, which is more or less complete, but I shall read you the first part of it. Rascal Saturday, Part 1. Janina Dineen could trace her personal insurrection back a couple of decades, but not until the day she strode the... half-deserted streets of Far West Soho did Janina feel like she was in Endgame. She had just turned 23 in March of 2069 and spoken to her left palm as she headed for Jacques, that moment's edgy, dangerous gallery of choice in Manhattan, the big arena. Even on a sunny afternoon, locals don't feel safe walking alone in parts of New York, she told Sandy, and held her hand with palm out so her soulmate could see the blank-faced warehouses and flood-damaged lofts, the occasional vehicle whizzing past. The dark side of the big arena is where art and bloodshed meet, Janina said. She glanced at her palm, saw Sandy propped up in a bed and looking quite amused. A few paces behind and to Janina's left was Massey, the escort bodyguard the Nanines always used in New York. As a little kid, she'd loved Massey, the blunt-faced city cop, doing private work on the side. Now she considered the woman old and in the way. Janina didn't fear the streets or anything else and wanted to show her friends some things that interested them both. But Sandy had told her, I need and love you too much to see you killed because you don't know about fear. Get protection. And having Massey scanning the vehicles on the avenue, keeping watch without being obvious, meant Janina could concentrate on Sandy, the one most often in her thoughts. Janina paused at a cross street, looked west, opened her palm, and held it up to show Sandy the massive Art Deco floodgates at the end of the block and the buildings still mangled from the river's last rampage 10 years before. She said aloud, the title of the show we're going to see is The Lordly Hudson. Sandy gave a loud chuckle. All kinds of irony and nostalgia. Looks like the Lordly Hudson paid an unwelcome visit to the neighborhood. The big arena isn't that far away from being on the margins. Sandy's eyes were animated, her face alive. A quilt covered her emaciated, motionless body. She wore a dark blouse, and around her neck was a silver chain with what looked like a medallion. It was, in fact, a coin of Naxos, the only one in this world, as far as either knew. Janine had given it to her in secret 7 years before when they first were friends. Massey spoke aloud. This is it. Across the street, on the second story of an old commercial building, a modest sign read, Jacques. No one used first-floor storefronts. The glass, the floods, the occasional bomb made them chancy. Around the building's entrance were half a dozen bodyguards brought by gallery-goers. The best, like Massey, were off-duty or retired New York cops, not so much for their personal skills as because it was understood that when they called for help, the police department actually responded. The guards acted as a funnel, letting only the right people climb the stairs. Black slacks with ankle boots and white silk shirts with puffed sleeves were what women of style wore in these mild last of winter days. Janina, arresting with dark glasses and her hair drawn back, had it down perfectly. Entering the gallery, she wondered how much longer she'd need to blend into this world and its ways. Men in the city that year favored short shorts and legs decorated with graceful green tattoos. Ron Jacques, the art dealer of the moment, had the best tattoos. The gallery was a spacious loft hung with 19th-century American art of a newly bankrupt collector. On the walls, Hudson River School paintings, rural scenes full of light reflected on water, green river banks, passing clouds, distant cattle, were interspersed with screens displaying similar items for sale in galleries around the world. Where are the illustrationists? Sandy wanted to know. On Janina's flight into the city, they'd talked about that famous and still controversial mid-19th century art movement. Along with writers like Alcott, Hawthorne, and Thoreau, the illustrationists came out of the seething 1850s mix of devotion, genius, eccentricity, and quite a bit more that was Concord, Massachusetts. Sandy had said, I know lots of movements claim to be the art of the future. The illustrationists were different. They said their art already contained the future. Landscape painters with a mission, they often got lumped together with the Hudson River School and its pastoral charms. In the gallery, Janina found an image of the most famous, or infamous, example of the movement's work, Anthony Cardno's 1848 oil painting, Manhattan Morning, seen from the Jersey Shore. Sailing ships lined the piers. Everything north of 14th Street was farms and shanties. At first glance, it was a fine example of the Hudson River painters. But looked at from the right angle, one could make out the semi-transparent ghost of the Empire State Building. The authenticity of this was disputed. No one had noticed the skyscraper in the picture until the building was under construction in the 1920s. Fraud was alleged, but unproven. Sandy's mobility was limited, but her curiosity was boundless. After staring at it for a few minutes, she asked, why is it just the Empire State Building? Nothing before, nothing after. If it wasn't for that ghost image, wouldn't this just be another painting? From conversations over the years, Sandy knew that Janina had grown up in a family where things stranger than this were taken as ordinary, and that Naxos was not just a silver coin. The two noticed that the early illustrationists, even without ghost skyscrapers, got a good bit of the attention in the gallery. This wasn't nearly as true for Ralph Conlon, in whom Janina took a special interest. If Conlon was remembered at all, it was as the last of the illustrationists. He worked almost to the turn of the 20th century. In his latter years, he was associated with the Ashcan school. Not so much as an artist, as a figure in the Ashcan painters' tumultuous New York street scenes. One of them had done a portrait of Conlon's studio. Lots of chaos, off-kilter drapes, half-finished canvases, a whiskey bottle on a table next to a can labeled Smith's and James Illuminating Powder. A green lizard sat on a pile of newspapers. The first time she saw it, Janina, the child of an art collector and an art historian, was reminded of the rabbits in paintings of Renaissance artists' studios. The rabbit's eyes had provided a needed ingredient for the paint. She always wondered if the lizard was somehow part of the illustrationist's process. Through Conlon's window, the hazy outlines of 1890s New York could be spotted. Not the Empire State Building again, Sandy murmured, and Janina chuckled. By then, it was getting late. Sandy flashed an image of armed soldiers herding California homeless onto buses and said, "Time spent with you is never wasted, but right now a screwed-up nation needs my attention, and thanks for the contact with a certain relative." More spirit than physical presence, Sandy was the creator of Beyond the Margins. With no legal standing and semi-undercover, BTM gave some degree of unity and organization to the gulag of wretched shoreline towns, farms engulfed by deserts, bankrupt cities, and fracked-out plains that stretched across North America. Fraying governments did little but monitor Beyond the Margins and their leader. Spies and cops, listening to their conversation, as they probably were, would find it a dead end. The two spoke in a kind of code when dealing with Sandy's politics and Janina's family. Alone, aware she might be observed, Janina continued to stare at Conlon's studio. On his walls, amid the clutter, were what looked like a couple of paintings, too small to be sure of, even with magnification. One of them seemed like a maddeningly familiar clue. Some months before, she'd shown the Conlon studio painting to her cousin, Lothario Denin, a sometime artist. Lothario, like all her family, had reason to be caught up by the illustrationists. He was fascinated. A bit later, he messaged, "Conlon's a big disappointment to illustrationist collectors. Fraser Museum is trimming back, selling what's described as Conlon impedimenta. Sketches, a couple of palimpsests, canvases he may be prepared and half erased. No sign of a lizard or the Smith's and James illuminating powder, sorry to say. Bought the lot cheap. But the major piece, the one that could turn a puzzle into a weapon, was still missing." Then, a couple of days before, skimming through auction subcatalogs, Janina spotted what could have been a fully realized version of the painting on Conlon's wall. It was for sale by a small gallery that didn't attribute it to anyone, but their photo was full-sized, and she studied it carefully. Conlon wasn't a first-rate artist, but he was more than a journeyman. What he'd painted was a 10-story tower with a window carved in the sides and stairs going around and around to a roof where a signal light burned. Janina was positive Conlon had actually seen the structure, just as she had. It was the watchtower at Naxos, New York, a city that had never appeared in any history or on any map. Seeing Conlon's sketch again convinced her. Standing in Jacques's, Janina contacted the small gallery, bought the painting, and arranged for shipping to Lothario at the Denin compound. Just then she got a message from her Uncle Jack at the compound. "I'm afraid I'm no longer fit for this world. Could you make the next Rascal Saturday, my last one here?" Janina felt a bit of sorrow, but saw how this fit into her plans. She said, "I'll be there, Rascal Saturday morning. Love you." She looked around the gallery, saw no man or woman who interested her, and went downstairs to dismiss Massey and find out what else New York held in store that evening. It might be her last in the big arena, for a while or forever.
Very nice.
Why, thank you.
And where is this going to appear?
It isn't finished yet, and I haven't submitted it anywhere.
Oh, okay.
But we will find this out eventually.
Well, you know, so many writers, this is a discussion that I have with lots of people, and Octavia Butler, whenever she would teach Clarion or wherever she was, the very first thing that she would discuss and teach was, you're going to be rejected, deal with it. What is your success rate? I've always had the impression that you have a very high success rate.
I've written, this is my 73rd story.
Wow.
I didn't sell the first story that I wrote. I started writing speculative fiction stories in 1990, and I've sold all of them. Except that first one and this one, which isn't finished. I haven't sold all of them on the first try, but a lot of
them... Well, yeah, I mean...
A lot of them have been requested, and, you know, somebody has asked me for a story, or it's a story I've done for a themed anthology, or it's a story that is going to be the original story in a collection of my own short stories. And
right.
So, like that. But
it's still an amazing record, isn't it?
It is. And each time I say it, you know, I feel I'm, you know, begging the gods to make sure I never have another story published. But...
Knockwood,
indeed, yes. But I've been very lucky. I mean, some people are good, some people are lucky. I chose to be lucky.
I mean, there are good writers who have walls plastered with rejection slips. And,
well, certainly,
and stories that never sell, they become trunk stories.
I don't have trunk. I don't have any trunk stories. In fact, because people ask, you know, it's a charitable... It's an anthology put out for a charity, and could they have a trunk story? And I don't have one. And so I write, I've been writing flash fiction pieces, and I had three of them. And
all, which we have to explain to listeners.
Oh, it's stories under 1,000 words.
Right.
And it's become a sort of sub-form. And I had three of them. In fact,
I've proposed to this station any number of times that we come up with something called Flash Fic Radio. So that instead of playing a song for 3 minutes or something during a show, here's a nice piece of fiction.
Right, and you flash fiction, if it's, you know, 1,000 words, it can be read in a few minutes.
Yeah.
But anyway, all three of those stories went away to, you know, anthologies of being put out by conventions or being, you know, put out by... I can't even remember what happened to them.
Charitable, mostly.
Charitable or, you know, people...
Or groups.
People starting... kids starting up a magazine in Brooklyn or something like that.
Yeah.
And...
And you say Brooklyn is common.
I do. I say that, yes. That's... If... It makes them angry, and anger is good for young writers, I think. So I'm writing, probably will write a couple of other flash fiction pieces for that.
We'll write one for this show.
Well,
record it, and I'll use it. I've got one piece from Michael Swanwick called Storyteller Rock, which I think he recorded for somewhere else, or he wrote it for somewhere else, and then he just emailed it to me.
Is it a flash fiction?
It runs 2.5 minutes, whole story.
Well, I will do that.
So I'm not even thinking of word count. It's 3 minutes or less, or
well, the,
or even I'll even take 5 minutes, but the point is
a couple of
great filler.
It is great filler. A couple of the flash fiction pieces, you know, nobody except the few who bought and read my collection If Angels Fight has seen mm-hmm. them. I can give you something. You can wait, and I can write you something.
Yeah, but I want you to read it.
I will do that. Yes, I will read it.
Yeah.
But yeah, that is an idea, actually, flash fiction.
No, and you know, I shouldn't mention this too much on the air, because it's a great idea.
It is. It's a great idea, yes.
If I say so myself.
You did. You said so yourself.
Yeah,
but you fulsomely believed it, obviously.
Yes, but I have proposed it time and time again to this radio station just for filler, just, you know, not necessarily for exclusively the use of Hour of the Wolf, but, you know, it's, we have all this music available, apparently none of it now, as far as I can tell. We're offline, by the way. We're broadcasting, but as far as I can tell, we're offline. I don't know if that means the podcast, the stream is working or not, because with the internet dead in this room, I can't find out.
Hmm.
And we're in such a, we're in the center of this huge building with concrete and metal all around us. I can't get a signal on my phone. So
well,
I can't
yes,
find out if we're streaming or
I
not.
I always think when I come here that, you know, if an atomic bomb hits the city, I will be...
We're safe.
It's safe, yes.
Yeah, this is one of the, yeah. the... Outside of being on top of a hill...
Being on top of a hill is a drag, yes, but this building looks like it could withstand a great, a direct hit.
Oh, yeah, I think, yeah. It's quite a...
testament.
Behemoth, I would say.
A testament to education.
Ah, okay, is that what it is? Delaney went here.
And it did him no harm whatsoever.
And Margot Adler went to high school at... I didn't know CCNY had a high school.
Had a high school. I don't think it still does, but yes, it...
Well, she went there briefly, then she went to music and art.
That wasn't... Schools attached to universities were not that uncommon in a prior time.
I know there was Hunter High School.
There's Hunter still is, I think.
Ah, okay.
I don't know. Maybe it isn't, but... yeah, there's a lot of...
Amy Goodman was a Hunter person all the way. Hunter High School, Hunter College, came to WBAI.
She sang the Hunter song.
Hunter... Well, Margot sang the music and arts song, which was done to the tune of Brahms' First Symphony.
You mean, da, 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 da,
oh, come ye, oh, come ye to music and art today. God help me, I know the lyrics.
Well, that is very beautiful.
Oh, it's a great piece of music, but the idea... Judith Sherman, former music director of WBAI and then became director of classical music for something called Columbia Records or something like that. You know, hires orchestras. Judith produced a wonderful show called Everybody's Making Money But Tchaikovsky. And it was a great collection of popular songs.
Based on his music.
Not just his, but...
Other people.
But other people as well.
Well, I mean, that Chopin...
Procol Harum.
That Chopin... too, that was turned into no stronger love or whatever
yeah.
it was. Yeah, I mean, there are dozens.
The Supremes
back
did something.
In, yes,
yeah.
back in the... Was it the Supremes or the Toys that did How
but,
Gentle is the
but,
How
but then,
Gentle is the Rain.
Yes.
Da, 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 da.
And then there was another... I think it was the Supremes, but there was another section of that show as well, which were mnemonics, ways that you could remember.
That's right.
And they were sung
It's a bird, it's a plane, it's a Mozart.
That one I don't know. But Sam Jolty, who did the show News for Car Owners 20 years before there was car talk, Sam Jolty, with his very, very Bronx accent, would be singing, "This is the symphony that Schubert wrote but never finished." It was a great show.
Yes,
I wish I had a copy.
Well,
of
you
that.
Know, Tchaikovsky, the thing about Tchaikovsky was he never had to make money. He had a patron who was very generous, and he was paid from the pretty much from the get-go.
By Ken Russell and other people like him.
Right, and he never wanted for money. And could go anywhere that he wanted. And as a result of this, he was a miserable creature. You know, you'd think he'd been the happiest composer there ever was, but no, apparently not.
I like the depiction of Chopin in Impromptu. That it's a James Levine movie. He's played by Hugh Grant.
Yes.
Of all people. Bernadette Peters and...
Yeah, no, there it's...
who is it who plays George Sand?
Oh, God.
And she has such a crush on Chopin.
Right, well, they had quite a mad affair.
Yeah, and that's what is... It's another Weekend in the Country story, a la Smiles of a Summer Night.
Well, yes... I have a book, which I have never read, actually. It's stories that George Sand wrote for her grandchild. It's fairy stories, because George Sand was of the French aristocracy. And
right.
In her old age, she apparently entertained her grandchildren. And I have this. I bought it at Books of Wonder, and thinking that, oh, boy, this will really be something. And I've never... I hate to read. And I never got beyond the first
few
pages.
That's why you're a writer.
That's why I'm a writer. Yeah, it's much easier to write.
At any rate, I'm sorry, somebody was, I think, texting me on what we were actually talking about.
You mean asking us what we were talking about? Tell them we have no idea.
Making a reference.
Really?
It's people who know my Twitter or Facebook. I mean, Twitter, I'm Jim Freund. It's easy. And Facebook, I'm Jim Freund. Or Hour of the Wolf.
As the mood is upon you.
Yes, exactly. And people can send messages there. And sometimes during a show, they involve the show.
Well, that is nice.
This one was from Farrah Mendelson.
And what did Farrah have to say?
Actually, didn't pertain
to our carrying
to
on.
This immediate thing.
Well,
to,
she would be very disapproving,
earlier.
I'm sure.
But anyway, probably. If nothing else, discussion of George Sand should
bring her tussling back to the.
I would hope. I would hope. And it's what, in England? She's in England, right?
As far as I know.
So this is not an early morning show. This is a breakfast show.
The breakfast show.
This is the breakfast show in England.
Those breakfast
in London,
shows,
yes.
They'd be a husband and wife,
That's
usually.
Why I wanted this time slot so badly, so it could be a breakfast
show in
London.
Yeah. They're all of those breakfast shows in which they'll be a husband and wife, and they would.
Breakfast with Les and Beth.
Well, that was just a play, but
a wonderful play.
It was a wonderful play, but it. Yes, and there would be all
and
of these.
And who was it? There was a real life couple that was based on. I'm forgetting their names. And I met one of them.
I have no idea which. Jinx Falkenberg, Jink and Tex Falkenberg.
No, were, that wasn't the...
But they were a couple.
I'm sure they were, but
there was one of the people from What's My Line, and her husband had a show.
Wasn't Dorothy Kilgallen.
No, it was somebody. But anyway, it was a common thing.
Wasn't Arlene Dahl. It was somebody along...
Right, she was a very strange-looking lady, and she... Her husband...
But somebody who I wrote checks for when I was a talent residuals clerk at Lester Lewis Agency. I've told you all those stories, how I
you
met
Alfred.
You told
me all the...
I've never told them on the air how I met Alfred Drake.
Nobody knows who he is anymore.
That's horrible. He is such a dashing, wonderful performer.
He was huge. He was huge in
Go
the American
YouTube,
theater.
People. Go
he
to
was
YouTube.
Huge in the... In the I mean, it was he had three enormous hits.
Kiss Me, Kate.
Well, first was Oklahoma.
Oh.
Then was Kiss Me, Kate. And then there was Kismet, which he owned.
He owned Kismet?
Yeah, he owned that. Well, I mean, it was an old... it was a father-daughter combination. And I'm not going to remember their names. I'm lucky to remember my name at this point. But they had... There was an old... tearjerker of theirs
Bobbles
that he bought Bob and they took there was a pair of gay guys from Florida.
But he's not in the movie. It's Howard Keel again?
Well, Howard Keel was always in the movie.
Yeah.
But it was a pair of gay guys from Florida and they had this wonderful business. They took
Rimsky and Korsakov.
They didn't do Rimsky and Korsakov, but they did Song of Norway.
Oh, my.
And they did Kiss, which was Grieg's music. And there was Kiss Me, Kate, which was... Kismet, rather, which was Borodin. And they did one of Tchaikovsky. Everyone did one of Tchaikovsky.
Exactly.
And I don't know what happened to them. I suppose they made enough money and went off to Florida together. But Yes, he did Kismet. In addition, when I was small...
So he commissioned it, basically, for himself.
Right.
And
but
he did Morrison. That was his wife, right?
Were they married?
Patricia Morrison, I believe so.
Well, she was a film actress.
Yeah, which he was never.
She was the female lead in Kiss Me, Kate.
Yeah, and
Dorothy Morrow was the young girl in Kismet, mm-hmm. and
but they
had some talent from the Met in there as well, because I mean it is kind of operatic.
Yeah,
I'm sure we're driving people away from the.
I think not.
But anyway, he did that. He also did Yeoman of the Guard, Gilbert and Sullivan's Yeoman of the Guard on television. Oh. He was Jack Point.
Wow.
And it was quite a cast. What's her name? Ado Annie from Oklahoma there was Phoebe.
Mm-hmm.
It was incredible. It was an incredible performance as Jack Point. He was in the Burton Hamlet. He was Claudius in the Burton Hamlet.
That's right.
And he was
the one directed by Gielgud.
The one directed by Gielgud, and he then did. There was a stage version of. This is so awful. When you're old, you forget everything. It was a movie made of a Colette novel. Gigi.
Yeah.
There was a stage version of Gigi, and he played the Maurice Chevalier part in that. And I don't think he was ever back on the stage after that.
Her full name, Eileen Patricia Augusta Fraser Morrison.
Yeah.
Long, and she worked for British intelligence. Oh, her mother worked for British intelligence in World War I.
By God,
100 years ago this month.
Smuggled documents.
I'm just reading The Guns of August for the first time now, so I can keep up with the news.
It's a rip-roaring.
It is.
Yes, it is. She was criticized for that. Historians hated it because she could write well.
Oh, God, she writes wonderfully.
Right, not accurately, but wonderfully.
I don't care how accurate it may or may not be. It's a great read.
Her problem is she takes, she has heroes and villains. And I'm sorry to say, in the
so
First
far,
World
everybody's
War...
everybody's a villain.
Sorry, in the First World War, there was a distinct lack of heroes.
which actually does seem to be... Morrison was in The King and I as well. But there's... What people can find on YouTube is Kiss Me, Kate from Hallmark Hall of Fame.
Yes, they did a TV version of it, which I saw as a kid.
Which is very short, and, if you watch the movie...
As Bill Hayes, because the dancing part is not a dancing part in the TV show,
right.
And it's Bill Hayes who was a serviceable tenor, and...
But in the movie, you get to see Fosse.
In the movie, it is indeed, yes.
It's almost the Hermes Pan did the choreography,
right.
and he allowed Fosse to just in the very beginning of From This Moment On, Fosse choreographed that, and that was his first film choreography.
Well, From This Moment On was not in Kiss Me, Kate on stage. That's an addition.
Yeah, Porter would do that a lot. There is no information on Wikipedia about her private life, which is okay by me.
I'll have to make something up.
Yeah, and post it. That's easy to do on Wikipedia. Anyway, it's already 2:30, and you want to read another piece.
If you... I think that's all right. I will do.
I'm willing to go the way you want. I'm just concerned about the time.
I will read for 15 minutes.
Great.
And then we will see. This is the final part of my story, Sleepwalking Now and Then, which you can read in its entirety online. It's tor.com, and it came out, was put up on July 9th. And it's the story centers around, and it's an immersive theater production set in it's in 2070, and it's in an old hotel over in Kipps Bay, a hotel in which two murders have occurred. Mm-hmm. And it's immersive theater. People go in there and are sucked into either the 1890s...
Like Sleep No More kind of thing.
We don't mention Sleep No More, but yes, like that. And
going back to the last conversation, Alfred Drake was married to somebody else, Esther Harvey Brown.
Right, she was nobody in particular, I think. But,
she's Mrs. Drake, if nothing else.
I'm sorry?
She was...
Mrs. Drake, yes.
If nothing else.
But I don't think she was in the business.
No, apparently not.
Apparently not, no. Anyway, this is immersive theater. People go and they're sucked into the goings-on. There are two deaths that took place. The man who... It's the Hotel Angoulême, and the man who built the hotel died falling down an elevator shaft. He's in pursuit of his daughter, who is a sleepwalker, and he steps into an elevator, thinking that she has gone on to into the elevator, and there is no elevator there, and he falls into the cellar. And the hotel goes on. It has a somewhat blemished reputation after that, because his private life is somewhat unseemly. And then in the 20th century, in the 1960s, a famous gay writer, designer, painter lives in the building, and he is also murdered, and it is his story. The thing about it is, what they need is a third act. They need a third person to be murdered.
Uh-huh.
And this is talked about all through the story, but I will start. In New York, it was shortly before midnight of Halloween 2060. Over the years, the holiday had surpassed New Year's Eve as the city's expression of its identity, especially at times like this, when the legendary metropolis was short of cash and looking for some new idea to carry it forward. In the Angoulême, it was time for a special midnight show. Playgoers entered, sleepwalking, through the lobby. From there, they either went up the stairs, waited for the elevators, or just looked for a place to sit while getting acclimated. Moslin had managed to exploit the lobby, its disreputable fallen majesty. It was a place made for loitering. Upstairs, each floor was set in a different decade. The lobby celebrated the entire sordid past. Here, a cluster of 1960s rent boys lingered in the shadow next to the main staircase, and several 1900s ladies of the evening, in big hats and bustles, stood near the ever-vacant concierge desk. Jeremy Knight waited in a side doorway of the building. At exactly 5 minutes after the final stroke of 12, he got the one-minute signal, walked a few feet down the sidewalk to the front of the hotel, and was flanked by security. They threw open the doors, and Knight, Jackie, entered the lobby, tall and wire-thin, his eyes hidden behind dark glasses, his blonde hair in a ponytail, down almost to his ass. Knight's surveyed the crowd. The show was booked solid for Halloween weekend. Advance sales were another matter, and his guts turned cold whenever that crossed his mind, so he didn't think about it. Knight was through the crowd before they were aware of him. He turned then to face them, and they saw Jackie Mack, couturier, poet, playwright, in a classic outfit of his own design, V-shaped, slim-waisted jacket, bell-bottom trousers, a wide tie with bright pop-out flowers that looked like faces. Jackie Mack had been known to wear miniskirts and silver knee boots, but not in this occasion. On cue, the public elevator doors opened. Customers hesitated, as always, about getting on board because of the legend surrounding the place. Of Jeremy Knight, it had been written, he was born to wear a costume. Put him in anything from a 1940 RAF uniform to a pink tutu, and he is transformed. He despised the description, but found that in roles like this, an actor grabbed inspiration wherever it could be found. Without missing a beat, Jackie Mack stepped backwards onto an elevator and seemed amused by the audience's fear. "Oh, it's safe," he somehow murmured and shouted in the same breath. "And if it begins to fall, just do as I do. Flap your arms and fly." From the elevator doorway, Mac gazed at the mannequins in the corner, saw something, and nodded. The audience watched, fascinated, as one of the figures, dressed in leather and a blood-red kerchief, stepped out of the shadows and walked, unsmiling, into the car. I was crucified just now by his glance, Jack announced, as the killer joined him and the door closed. Alone, without an audience to overhear them, Jeremy and Remo, the young actor who played the killer, didn't exchange a word. Each got off on a different floor, and over the next hour, made rehearsed appearances in dark halls and bright interiors. Halloween week was great. Capacity crowds were willing and able to laugh and scream at every performance. On the third floor of the Angle Inn, 2 weeks later, at about an hour and 20 minutes into sleepwalking, Knight, Jackie, climbed onto the small stage in Mac Studios and felt the difference. The studio included a large performance space with 60 chairs set up. At the Halloween midnight show, all seats had been taken, and many more patrons stood or sat on the floor. Halloween had been a triumph, but it's in the week between holidays that hit shows are revealed and flops begin to die. Jeremy Knight had that in mind as he pirouetted on the stage. He estimated 30 people in the seats, and this included the killer, always the first to arrive. Remo was also Jeremy Knight's understudy. He sat down front, with his legs stuck out so far, his booted feet rested on the stage. Little knowledge of history, and one would be reminded of Jackie Mack's fatal tastes. The undercapacity crowd bothered Knight, but he told himself that any audience of any size was fated to be his. And the people at these performances, who sat on antique wooden folding chairs, were willing extras. They were drawn to the studio by the sounds and the lights flashing through the open double doors. Or they were told not to miss this by friends who had seen Knight Jackie perform this monologue, one-man play, stand-up routine, whatever you wanted to call it. Jackie Mack's writing was out of copyright, and the playwright had lifted big chunks of it for a play within a play called A Death Made for Speculation. Jackie leaned over the front of the stage, hummed a few bars of music, and said in a husky voice, "I'd thought of coming out in an evening gown and doing a Dietrich medley, but I've seen the way women look at me when I do drag. It's the look Negroes get when a white person sings the blues. So I am here to fulfill a secret dream. I'm playing a guy." They had taken liberties with the decor, but 1970 was a hard moment to exaggerate. Jackie's loft had been described and shown in articles, books, and documentary footage. Like Warhol's factory, it was iconic. On the walls and above mantelpieces were mirrors, which, at certain angles, turned into windows looking into other rooms. In these rooms, doll automata played cards, a mechanical rogue and his partner cavorted, and one or both might look your way, indicate you were next. "When I was young," Jackie Mack said, "I tried to make myself look beautiful. Later, I tried to make myself look young. Now I'm satisfied with making myself look different." In the lawless 1960s, the Angle Inn Hotel was almost as famous as the Chelsea across town. When it was sold as co-op apartments and lofts, Jackie bought most of the third floor of the building with the proceeds of his clothing line and his performance art. Jackie Mack was not, of course, his real name, which was boring and provincial. Donald Spring. For Jeremy Knight, the task was making something as ordinary as homosexuality feel as mysterious, hysterical, and dangerous as Jackie had found his life to be. A brief film clip existed of Jackie Mack working out some of this material in the studio, performing for an audience of friends in just this manner. Jeremy caught the odd, fluid, near dance of Jackie Mack, which had learned from old videos. On the wall, Hendrix, Joplin, and Dayglo acrylic nude boys and girls melted into a landscape of red and blue trees. A light show played intermittently on the ceiling. Deep yellow blobs turned into crisp, light green snakes, which drowned in orange quivering jelly. The color spectrum dazed the eye. Knight Jackie leaned forward to show a once angelic face, now touched with lines and makeup, and asked, "Why do men over 30 with long hair always look like their mothers?" On cue, the killer, down front, swallowed a few pills, stood up, pulled a bottle from his back pocket, spat out "faggot" at Jackie, and walked toward the door while taking a long slug. In the old-fashioned manner, Jackie Mack liked his partner's rough. It would be the death of him. The audience watched the long, slow exit. Wrist limp, Jackie Mack gestured after him. "We have the perfect relationship. I pretend he doesn't exist, and he pretends that he does." It wasn't just the costume. Jeremy Knight had absorbed every bit of the lost manner and voice of somebody society hated for what he was. 90 years later, it was hard to convey. For a few years in his teens, Jeremy had been Jenna Knight, making the change because boys in school got neglected, and there was an advantage to being a boy with the mind of a girl. Each day, Knight fell closer to Jackie's alienation, saw it intertwined with his own fear of falling off a very small pedestal and back into the vast, penniless crowd in the big arena, as New York was now called. The killer stopped at the door and yelled, "It's your turn now, bitch," and somebody no one could see. Jackie glanced his way, turned back to the seats, and found everyone staring wide-eyed. "Dear me, are the snakes growing out of my head again? That Medusa look was so popular once upon a time." He peered at the crowd and remarked half to himself, "Judging by your faces, I've turned you all to stone. Forgive me, my mother always said..." But few were listening. All eyes were on a figure in silk floating past the stage, humming "Beautiful Dreamer" under her breath, while the audience whispered her name. The author had invented liaison in this hotel between self-destructive artist and the ghost of a legendary suspected murderess. The character Jackie was haunted by Evangeline decades after she had died of an overdose. Once he caught sight of her, he seemed to forget the audience completely and followed her out of the room. When the audience members came after them, they found a locked door. But the room into which the two had gone was Jackie's legendary mirrored bedroom. The ceiling, an entire wall, and even the floor in places reflected the room and its outsized bed. One wall was a two-way mirror. Jackie was always aware of this, as were some of his bedmates. The sleepwalking audience flocked around the glass, saw silhouettes dance in semi-darkness as Jackie tried to trap Evangeline, or she ensnared him. One shadow seemed to pass through the other. One or the other always had a back to the audience, and both whispered, so none outside could hear. "How's the gate tonight?" she asked. 70% for this show. "About the same for the midnight show," he said. "Hell," she said, "it's going to fold." "Needs a third act," he said. "I have my eye out for especially unstable repeat patrons." "A third victim," she said. "Rosalind's got one, but Sonia scares me." He shook his head. "She's harmless." "A suicide might do," Kerry said. "I volunteer my understudy, Remo." "Silly, understudies don't want to die. They want to kill the leads." Through the glass, the two heard, "Where are you, faggot?" "Screwing the ghost girl?" The killer had returned. Jeremy took a deep breath and walked out of the bedroom. "Let's talk," one faggot to another. "I'm the terrible secret, the herpes sore on the 10-inch sausage, the skunk at the tea dance, the troll without the decency to hide under a bridge. I'm the one who's here to call you sister to tell you." In sleepwalking, the killer emptied the pistol into him just as had happened in real life. Audience members screamed. Kerry always stayed for this and always had to stop herself from crying. Then she'd slip out for her next big scene with Nance.
Wow.
As I say, that is online in its entirety. And yeah, you can read that, which you should do.
I intend to, and I trust listeners of discerning...
listeners taste. Of discernment, yes, should go out
we'll,
and do. It's
we'll
free.
Do the same.
It's free, and so
a
few things are.
This is at Tor, but the easiest...
The easiest way to do it, you put in...
The easiest way is to go to your website. I assume you've linked to this.
My website is, like, in abeyance at this point. The easiest way to do it, it's you put in Richard Bowes, if you want to do
B-O-W-E-S.
It that way.
B-O-W-E-S.
And it's... Just put, quote, sleep, walking. And sleep and walking are separate words. Sleep, walking, now and then. Quotes.
Actually, Richard Bowes, quote, sleep, walking, two words, should do it.
It should do it, yes.
There aren't going to be too many other things that fit that criteria.
No, especially since sleepwalking is actually one word.
Exactly.
We did that, in fact, to make it stand out. And, yeah, it's tor.com. It went up on July 9th and got very nice reviews. But, yes. Do go read it. And you can make remarks. That's the other nice thing at Tor. You can make little remarks. I'd prefer complimentary ones, but
yes,
you can make any kind of remark you wish.
Yeah, Yeah, the website I work for has the same thing, but they're moving away from doing remarks on the website and bringing it more to social media. But Tor has a far more active social media life.
It's quite amazing.
Its, than Lightspeed, which is where I'm working.
The Tor.com reminds me of sci-fiction.
Well, given that they have an editor in common, although right. Sci-fiction, Datlo was pretty much the only editor.
She was the editor, yes.
Yes.
And,
Oh, you know, I just ran into Pam Weintraub. Pamela Weintraub with Ellen Datlo were Omni Magazine Online.
Right. That's right.
I ran into her about 3 weeks ago.
That's right. That was Ellen's first online episode.
Yes, and I worked for them. I was one of their two online hosts for their chaps, me and Ed Bryant. And I got such a thrill of saying, Ed Bryant and I are doing this job. That was... So there was Omni Online, which then gave way to Event Horizon, which is a website way before its time.
Yes, it was. And,
I mean, today it would be considered one of many good science fiction, fantasy, specific websites.
But it'll be up there with Clark's World and Lightspeed.
Exactly.
And Tor.com.
Exactly. But then, no other such thing existed, and there wasn't an... And
well,
this is when people didn't know how to monetize the web.
Well, also, I'm not sure they do yet, but there was no audience looking for fiction online.
Right.
What happened in the 1890s, in the 1990s, the 1890s.
Might as well have been, given...
The idea of the Internet far exceeded the actual existence of the Internet.
The web.
The web, rather.
Yeah.
Far exceeded the actual existence of the web. And, I remember we moved into the Pope's Library in 1974.
Mm-hmm.
At NYU, we moved from all the 17 small libraries.
You're a librarian at NYU.
I was a reference assistant.
Oh, okay.
I wasn't a librarian.
I always get that wrong. I don't know why.
Well, everybody thinks everyone who works in a library is a librarian.
Yeah.
Like everyone in a hospital is a doctor. But it's the idea was the place
only DG
was Creed. Full. Place was you know full of books, but this wasn't going to matter. In 1974, because the Papalist Library was right around the corner. And in fact, the Papalist Library was around the corner, but the corner was about 30 years in the future.
Yeah.
But the Papalist Library was absolutely believed in. The belief in the web far preceded anything that ever happened on the web. The first
before
time.
Before the web, there were websites. There were gopher sites.
Right.
There were online repositories of fiction before Gutenberg.
Right, before anybody.
Gutenberg, people think of it as the first. It's the first major web.
And the most advertised.
And,
That was the other thing. Nothing that was put on the web was ever... Nobody was ever told it was... There was no way to discover where anything was.
Actually, there was. In those days, Yahoo was good.
Yahoo
was a great discovery.
Yahoo
place.
Was a great discovery, but unless you knew these things existed, you couldn't put them in to do a search for them.
Well, netizens, as we called ourselves, web enthusiasts,
yes.
We knew to go to Yahoo for site of the day.
Right.
When site of the day was actually a manageable concept.
Well, one of the things, the first computer I ever used was when we moved into the library, and it was very simple. you could go to it, and the New York State library system, which is an excellent library system, was there.
By the way, every time you do that, it makes a wonderful percussive sound.
I like that, you know, boom.
But yeah, put on your headphones, and you'll
no, I have not.
You'll get an idea.
Sorry for
it's
that.
It's very cool. I told that to Daniel J. Older, and he performed the desk on the air. It's very good.
Well, anyway, we had this device. You could look in there and see which libraries, there was a book that somebody wanted to borrow that we didn't have, you could see what library had the thing. Very simple. Except that, strange thing happened late in the afternoon. Suddenly, all there was were numbers on the screen. It was numbers with some letters in them. And we were mystified by this in our simple library worker kind of way. And it turned out what it was is after 4 in the afternoon, the state police got the use of the computer, and these were stolen cars, the license plates of stolen cars.
Oh, my duck. Oh, that's wonderful.
Yes. And then I was told, although I never saw this, at about 11 o'clock at night, it went to some medical authority, and I don't know what that was. It counted the medicines or something. But then 9 o'clock the next morning, you could look up books again. But, yeah, it was simple and yet mystical beyond.
I used to, in the days of BBS's, bulletin board services, I would get onto the New York Public Library catalog.
Leo.
That was later.
Well, that was what it was called.
Nipple.
Right, but it was called, the thing was called Leo by the people who ran it.
Well, the BBS itself, the catalog itself, it had a different name when you got in there, which is still actually used by them. And one time I went to the library, and I had my old Atari computer. This is the early 80s we're talking about, okay? The early 80s, 15 years before the web. And I asked about it, and they said, what do you mean? What do you know? I said, I log in. There's a phone number. It's advertised. You go in, and basically, you know, you can look up stuff like you would with a Delaney card. And they had guards surround me.
That's good.
They saw me as a hacker. Now, this was a public thing that, in fact, was being advertised by members of the library. But the people working the desk at the whatever the name of the 42nd Street branch, the library, the main...
It's the main library.
It's the main library, but it actually has a name. They were unfamiliar with this, and they assumed anybody who was getting into their computer system was a hacker. And it was like, excuse me, I think I got the phone number out of the New York Times.
That's no excuse.
Yeah, basically, that was their
thing. I hope you were thrown out and never let back in.
They wanted to throw me out, and I basically made a fuss and said, I host a radio show, and believe me, everything that happens here is going to become very public.
And what was their reaction to that?
Their reaction was to hold me in abeyance and have me talk to somebody. And finally somebody was there and said, yes, I put out that phone number all the time so that people can come and use the resource. This is the future. And there's nothing private in there. Can you change the data? I said, no. I can just look up books. All I have to do is look up, you know, the name Sheckley, Robert, and find what books are in the main branch.
I hope they didn't have any of his books in the main branch.
Actually, they did.
Oh, I am shocked.
And Ziva, if you are listening, you
I am know. Shocked and dismayed.
Yeah.
Well, no, I think that arresting customers and patrons and throwing them out of the building is... Certainly, it's library. Well. It's what all people working in libraries want to do.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So, in other words, Rick, these are your library fantasies as a researcher at NYU for how many years?
35 years. 35
years.
35 years.
Yeah. You see, you have revenge fantasies.
No, they're not fantasies.
Okay, well, you actually arrested people and threw them out?
Very seldom. Very occasionally, yeah.
Yeah, basically, yeah.
At first, when we first moved in there, anyone who wanted could come in whenever they wanted. And there were some quite appalling things. One day I came in and there was a message on my desk that said, the NYU security guards are a highly professional force. And I said, they're a nice enough group of people. But the night before, a librarian in one of the information centers, something had gone wrong. And she called security and she said, you had better get the real police. This is very serious.
Oh! Listen, we're in the middle of CCNY right now. I'm not sure how safe I feel in telling that story.
But, and it was, we never heard the end of that. That was...
That's...
Their feelings were hurt.
And darn well they should be.
Get the real police.
Yes, I know the feeling. Well, there were times... I can show you the little bump on my head from the guards and cops at Columbia University who clubbed me unconscious once when I was a young teenager. It's true.
No, the guards at NYU.
This was, of course, during a student
demonstration.
More than demonstration, a takeover of
right.
The famous Mark Rudd SDS thing. I was delivering batteries.
I knew a story about Mark Rudd. A friend of my brother Jerry's came from, his father was a cop and his brother was a cop.
Everybody in your family's cop. You're from Boston.
No. These were out in Long Island. They were Italian-American cops. The Irish cops, something else. and the brother, because he was a kid, he was allowed to grow his hair long, and he became an undercover cop. He became Mark Rudd's bodyguard. And the way he did this was by showing them his police... I mean, these people... He showed them his police revolver, and they were so impressed by this, they made him Mark Rudd's bodyguard.
Oh, my God.
So when the cop showed up, and, you know, everything, the first thing that happened was that Mark Rudd's bodyguard arrested him.
Jeez. That's amazing.
It wasn't
during this particular demonstration.
Well, the thing about it was
because he was the one in charge, pretty much. He was the spokesman on TV.
No, it took a few. The cops. Yes, the amount of first of
the
all,
the SDS people finally wised up.
It took so much.
When your bodyguard arrests you, you should start being suspicious of his alliances.
Of many things.
Or
but
allegiances.
It also, why did the police even bother with this? Oops, sorry.
Yeah, no, I
Why did the police even bother with such nonsense? I mean, you know.
Well, that's another question altogether, and best left for another program. But we are, believe it or not, actually out of time.
Sorry.
I'm sorry to
hear
too.
This.
A 90-minute show doesn't
even begin to fulfill our need to talk.
We're going to start an entire new episode of Hour of the Wolf in 3 minutes.
Goodness gracious!
But this is a recorded.
Yes, with Margot Adler.
With Margot Adler, it is. Well, I'll intro it at that time, and I'll outro this program now. My guest has been Richard Bose, who is available at rickbose.com, RICKBOWES.
Right, and I'm on Facebook and Twitter, which is mainly where...
Oh, you're on Twitter now.
I'm on Twitter, but mainly Facebook.
Facebook, yeah.
Yeah, but I have a Twitter account.
Yeah,
and
everybody has a computer has access to the web. Not everybody likes to do Facebook.
Nonsense. Everybody does Facebook.
Yeah, well, except the person who was going to be our guest tonight, Veronica Shaness, who's going to be here in a few weeks instead. Karen Hewler is on Facebook, and she will be the guest next week. So... September 9th, New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, 388 Atlantic Avenue, 6:30 p.m., doors open, Walter Mosley, Paul D. Filippo. The name of the movie opening Friday?
Jamie Marx is Dead at the Village Cinema.
Based on the novel by Chris Barzak.
One for Sorrow.
One for Sorrow. Great novel. Thank you all for listening. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. You can write me, jim@ourwolf.com, H-O-U-R-W-O-L-F. I, too, am on Facebook, and there's an Hour of the Wolf group on Facebook as well.
Which is also you.
Which is also, I have three groups, or two groups. I have my page, the NYRSF, New York Review of Science Fiction Readings page, and the Hour of the Wolf page.
You are so many people.
I am. I really am. So,
three gyms in one go.
Again, thank you all for listening. Stay tuned, and I will be right back. Good morning. And you're tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifico Radio, New York City, WBAI at 99.5 FM. Coming up, another episode of Hour of the Wolf, this one from early November 2010, the last episode of Hour of the Wolf in its original time slot where it resided for 39 years. Your host is Margot Adler. I hope you enjoy it. Stay tuned.
Welcome to Hour of the Wolf with the wonderful strains of the theme, or one of the themes from Silent Running. And this is Margot Adler. I'm along with Jim Freund, and we're celebrating the 40th anniversary of Hour of the Wolf.
Well, I have to apologize because I put on the wrong episode. I had two episodes on this computer, and somehow I screwed up. I'm not very familiar with this automated system. This was, what you're hearing is, as Margot said, this is actually from 2012, in January, the 40th anniversary of the show. And that was actually in this time slot, as a matter of fact, or would have just ended. That was from midnight to 3 a.m. So I have to figure out, how to stop this and insert the track that I originally planned to play. That's a three-hour show, and I cannot do that, as decent a show as that was. But I am okay. So let's see now. Here we go. Yes. Okay, and... Okay, that's very strange. This seems to have a whole different time attached to it. This one... Okay, pardon me while I try to... We have this automated broadcast system here. And I am most unfamiliar with it. And what I need... this one seems to time out at 90 minutes. A little over 90 minutes, in fact. Which means that instead of running long, it's going to run short. And you and I, Rick Bowes, we are going to continue for about another 20 minutes.
Really?
Yeah, well, let me open your mic so that we can do just that.
What shall we do for these 20 minutes?
Well,
what shall we ever do?
I'm going to try to cue up this episode, among other things. Delete track. Yeah, and I am, you know, I should have known when I heard that howl because I edited this just this afternoon, although I thought I edited it down to 2 hours. So what I'm going to ask you to do is to chat for a bit.
Well, what shall we speak about?
No, not we.
Oh, it's just
you.
Me. I am just going to speak
you.
Endlessly about endless
nonsense. Well, you know, choose a topic. What movies have you seen? What theater have you seen lately?
Well, that's interesting. I can't remember anything that I've done now that I'm actually put to the test.
Yeah, okay. Now that I put you on the spot, right?
Boyhood.
Oh, how was that? The Richard Linklater film.
You know,
I tend to like him.
It was, in the end, it just was, you know, the story of a rather nice but not, you know, really exceptional kid. It was the stages that he went through and... The fact that, you know, this was a movie, I mean, I think he goes from the ages of 7 to 17 or...
And that's like 15 years that he covers, right?
Is it that long? I don't think it's quite that long, but it's the same kid. You know, usually if it's a movie, there, when one goes from a small child to, you know, basically an 18-year-old going away to college, it'll be played by three different children.
Right.
In this case, it's the same kid. And they're very fortunate in that, you know, he doesn't, by the time the movie is over, he doesn't weigh like 400 pounds. And, you know, he's good. The kid delivers a good performance. It's an unusually wrought story in that the plot, there is no plot. The plot is his getting older, his growing up. And his has to suffer with the bad judgment of his mother, who divorces the father, who seems like a nice guy, but obviously...
That's Ethan Hawke?
Ethan Hawke, yeah.
Who's one of Linklater's...
Standards,
muses. Or...
Right. And he's a nice guy, but, you know, a little out of it. Her next husband is a monster, or is revealed as a monster. I mean, he really is quite awful. And the kid, you know, suffers through these things, as kids do at this point. I mean, when I was a kid, you pretty much, you know, you were started out with a pair of parents, and they pretty much were your parents.
It's different. It's an unusual story. It's an unusual way of telling the story. It has no... There's no moral in the thing. It's just we see him turn into basically a very, you know, a young adult.
So would you compare this at all to, like, you know, the 57 Up and that series of films?
No, you know...
Are not fiction.
No, the 7 Up series, the thing with that, those are interviews, and the thing in the 7 Up series is... the director is much better at getting people to be themselves than one would think he was. I mean, I've seen him in person speaking, and he doesn't seem like somebody who could make people as at ease as the people in the 7 Up series are. I mean, some of the people in the 7 Up series are quite horrible and quite happy about this. And the English caste system is, oh my goodness gracious, alive and well in there. This has a bit of that, but it is one kid, his parents, and the people that they have chosen to live with. I was taken with it. The last part of it seemed to go on too long. Because the whole point of it is he's just a kid. He's an ordinary person. I mean, he's extraordinary in the way that, you know, every kid is. I mean, But, yeah, that was the most inarticulate description of a film.
Would you recommend it?
I'm sorry?
Would you recommend it?
Yes, I would. It's not a bad way to spend the afternoon or the evening.
Yeah, I think we're going to be having a movie reviewed. I only just heard about it. Do you know anything about this movie called The Congress, starring Robin Wright and Harvey Keitel?
The Congress of the United...
The Congress. And it is based on the Futurological Congress by Stanislaw Lem.
Dear heavens, no.
Yeah, this is like this movie sort of out of nowhere that's gone direct to video, directed by the same fellow who did Waltzing with Bashir. And it's about this actress named Robin Wright, who's, you know, 25 years ago or something, did a movie called The Princess Bride and hasn't been
anywhere
prominent since. So she allows herself to become digitized. And that's all live action. Now the movie jumps forward 70 years or something, and it's an animated film. And it now follows the story of the Stanislaw Lem novel, but instead, but with Robin Wright playing a fictional computerized version of herself in the lead. How's that for a curious science fiction film that's currently running that nobody's... I saw it mentioned in passing in the New York Times. I went to my streaming internet box from Roku, and bingo, there it was.
But
it's not free. It's like $5 or something.
You haven't watched it.
I haven't watched it yet. Dan Persons, our tentpole movie reviewer, has, and he liked it. He thinks it's interesting. He liked it for the most part. He had problems with Robin Wright playing Robin Wright, just like, yeah, and that's becoming a trope, you know, ever since Being John Malkovich, Malkovich playing Malkovich, and Paul Giamatti in Cold Souls, which is my favorite of this genre of film.
Well, the thing with Inside John Malkovich, or being whatever it was, being John Malkovich, he doesn't really play himself.
No, well, that's...
I mean, he's
in
acting.
In each of these cases,
right. They're
playing fictional versions of themselves.
Although, yeah.
Malkovich is more removed
right. From
who he is in real life than any of these other people. So I found, by the way, the correct file to put on. The problem is that we're 15 minutes into it. It does run 2 hours. And this is the one that I was hoping to play. I hear it in my headphones. The question is, in this software, is there a way to skip ahead? I'll let people hear.
When ghosts and demons are most powerful.
Now you put on your headphones, right?
The hour of the wolf is also the hour when most children are born.